We hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope, that is, many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on NABAClub.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves to and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of those two. I must have this thing. And Tim is going to introduce our speaker tonight.
Thank you, Rachel. Great job. Tonight, Joette P. Is going to tell her story. She's been sober since March 10th, 1997. Her home group is the First Things First women's group at Serenity House. Serenity House had a big part of my recovery, and Joette is going to show you what they can teach you there, too. Please give Joette a great warm welcome to Nella.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you to everyone who read. My name's Joette. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to take a moment and just say a little prayer, if you don't mind. Father God, be with me now as I carry your message. When anyone anywhere reaches out for the hand of AA, I need to be there. Thank you for giving me your words. In your name, amen. Okay, I'm really grateful to be here. I, believe it or not, tried to get sober. Heather was reminding me, I brought my sister, Heather. This is the first time she's ever heard me tell my story. So when I leave here, I'm sure she'll tell me how many lies I've been telling for the last 15 years every time I do this. You know, our reality is not necessarily the truth. It's just the story we've been telling ourselves. I found that out in my fourth and fifth step. I got sober on March 10th, 1997. My home group is the First Things First Women's Group in Buford. I love my home group. I have a sponsor, V. Baker. I love my sponsor. She's the best sponsor ever. And I sponsor about 7 women right now. I love them. I didn't know I had the capacity to love one more person. And every time I take on a new sponsee, God just shows me there is a never-ending capacity for love in my heart and my life. Thank you. And I'm just so grateful that God uses me for that purpose today. When I got here, I didn't really have a purpose. I wasn't even really wanting to live. And I couldn't understand how or why I got sober. I felt like somebody opened a window and jerked me through it. And God's grace was on the other side. And for whatever reason, I'm sober today. I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to a young mother. My parents were 17 and 19, I think, when I was born. My dad split when I was very young. My sister and I were raised by a single teenage mom who really wasn't equipped to deal with life. She just didn't have the skills to cope any more than I did when I got here. And over the years, I've learned that I'm capable of making a lot of the same mistakes she made. Our childhood was hard. It was poverty, hunger, abuse, a lot of fear. We were born in Milwaukee, but my mom took us to Cincinnati where we didn't have any family or friends, and we lived a mostly isolated life. I didn't know that the rest of the world didn't suffer from that kind of abuse. Constant screaming. I got on the school bus most days at 7 o'clock in the morning already having gone through hell. And there wasn't really anybody to talk to about that. It was just us. So, you know, I was angry. I was angry and afraid and violent at a young age. My mom worked nights and bartended a lot. Waitress, that kind of thing, and Heather and I were probably 6 and 4 when she started leaving us alone at night. And we do what young kids who are unsupervised do. We got in trouble, so her solution was to lock us in our bedroom while she went to work at night. And, you know, we were little skinny monkeys, so we'd get out of there. We could get out of any trap she put us in. But, you know, that was just to give you an idea of how she coped with life. That was her solution. She really didn't have a better answer. She had to work, and she had to find a way to keep her children safe, and that made sense to her at the time. And today I know that I can love her in spite of that, in spite of any of it. I started drinking and using when I was 11 in Cincinnati, and you'll hear Beth and Chuck Hartley, who are great people, talk about Cincinnati. We go in the woods and drink there, I guess. I don't know why, but they're, you know, our neighborhoods with woods all around them, and it was really cool for all the kids to go in there and smoke pot and drink beer and whatever pills or anything we could steal from our parents, and we just do that. And for me, you know, I remember the ease and comfort immediately that our book talks about. You know, I had a lot of screaming monkeys in my head already at 11. Life was really hard, and I was so angry. And I remember feeling the relief that came from drinking. It worked for me. And we went to pretty great lengths every day to find whatever we could get. You know, and back then you can get an adult to get beer or anything from the corner store, cigarettes, that kind of thing. We stole pot and pills from our parents, and we drank every day. It seemed like we could get it any time. And it worked for me. You know, life didn't get much easier. By the time I was 14, I was absolutely out of control, and my mom was at the end of her rope. And the violence, you know, as soon as I got big enough and strong enough to hit back, it wasn't about her abusing me anymore. It was about us fist fighting. And that happened almost every day. And at 14, she couldn't take it anymore, and she was ready to throw me out. I ran away. It was a summer where I was sleeping on friends' couches, and I went away to camp, and I was just out there. And when I got back, my bags were packed, and she sent me to live with my grandmother until they could figure out what I was going to do. But I wasn't going to stay there anymore. That summer, while my family in Wisconsin kind of decided what was going to happen, I was separated from alcohol. Now, at that young of an age, it's not anything you think about. I was using and drinking all the time. I mean, we'd drop acid and go to Kings Island and spend the day out there as kids. It was just normal for us. And I didn't have any alcohol. I had to go stay with my uncle for the summer until they could figure out what was going to happen. And I was separated from alcohol at 14. And that was my first experience with what this book tells us is restless irritability and discontent feeling that alcoholics get when they don't have the solution, which alcohol absolutely was my solution. It was my answer. And I remember feeling hopeless and helpless and suicidal. And, like, I was the worst person on the planet at 14. I was just bad, and I didn't know why. You know, nobody had ever talked to me about alcoholism. My mom dated musicians and hung out with people who partied. And there were, you know, musicians at our house when we were in our pajamas, and they were cutting the seeds out of their weed on our little TV trays with kittens and cartoon characters on them, and we're hanging around. And that was normal life for us. Nobody had ever talked about alcoholism, the disease, addiction, any of that. It was a normal part of my life. People drank and used. My family drinks hard. So I was lost and alone. From there, I went to live with my Aunt Donna, my mom's older sister. She had five kids, and she lived in the northern part of Wisconsin, dirt roads, right on Lake Superior. I was isolated from the world. And her oldest daughter was going to college. Her youngest daughter was just starting kindergarten, and I got to move in there with that big family. And I really believe they saved my life today. When I got there, I was defiant, had no respect for authority, and I was on a mission to get high and drunk. That's all I cared about. And my life had seemed so hopeless at the time, the consequences didn't even matter to me. I didn't know that's alcoholism, that above anything, I was going to go out and get drunk. I needed the alcohol. I didn't know that's what was happening to me. I just know that being grounded or not getting to go to so-and-so's party or getting that look of disappointment from my uncle, who was just such a nice guy, none of it mattered. I had to go out and get alcohol, and if that meant I stayed past my curfew, then I would do that. If that meant I went where I shouldn't have gone, then I did that. If I had to steal your car, then I did that. If I had to steal your money, then I did that too. And this is what I did to the people I loved. The alcoholism at that time was already driving me to do things that I felt powerless over, and I didn't know why. Somehow I managed to graduate. I was 16 in my senior year, and I was already drinking daily. I was filling chloroseptic bottles with vodka, which I could still get No problem. All my friends up there, there was the Port Bar and the Crow Bar and the Green Top Bar. And I mean, if you blink going through my hometown, you miss it. There's 5 bars, a co-op, an A&W, and a bank. And that's it. All my friends' parents had bars, and we just took the liquor out of their refrigerators in their garages or in their houses or from the bars. So I was able to always have booze. And my aunt and uncle didn't have it in their house. I didn't take it from them. They didn't drink or use like that. But I managed somehow every day. Now, I don't know how I graduated. I didn't even care. I really just wanted to drink. And I'd fill those chloroseptic bottles with vodka. Sometimes I put food coloring in it. Sometimes I wouldn't. But I'd go to my locker and spray vodka into my mouth all day, every day. I would go out at lunch and smoke with my friends and come back and go to English class again and not really care. I was in sports. I ran track. I played basketball. I barely managed to pass classes, but I did. Even then, I think I was, just surviving. That's what it felt like every day. I was just surviving, and I was so tired. When I graduated, my mom convinced me to come back to Cincinnati and go to college. I didn't want to go to college. I just wanted to drink. College didn't work out. If I went to class, I was already high. If I made it at all, I stayed up and drank all night long. I found the Rasa Band and hung out with those people, and I partied. I wanted to go in the Air Force on a dare. Somebody dared me when I was high, and I signed up. And I really didn't want to do that. I just wanted a drink. And I got myself kicked out of there. And when I left there, I got married at 19 and moved to Toronto to a musician. And, you know, I didn't want to do that. I just wanted a drink. But there, we worked all week, and we used all of our money to buy booze, and I drank it away over the weekend. And by Monday, I had to go back to work just to make the money to buy the booze to drink all weekend. And that was my life at 19. I didn't want to be married to him. I didn't care about anything. I just wanted to drink. So at that time, my sister had moved from Cincinnati to Atlanta. And she came here and called me and said, "You are not going to believe this city. You've got to get down here." And what she found was the adult entertainment industry. So I hopped on a Greyhound bus and left Toronto. Now, what I didn't know, again, was anything about alcoholism. I didn't know, because I had never tried, that when I stopped drinking, my body was going to retaliate. And by the time I got to Cincinnati on the Greyhound bus, I thought I had the flu. And I had to get to my mom's house. I called her, and she still lived in Cincinnati. I said, "I'm going to need to come and spend the night at your house. I don't feel good. I can't take this bus ride anymore." Now, how I had the flu but still wanted to drink wine at her house, it never occurred to me. But the wine cured the flu, and I was able to make it to Atlanta the next day, and I felt better. I still didn't know anything about alcoholism. When I got to Atlanta, they were there. They picked me up and brought me straight to Tattletales, and that was my life. And I had arrived. You know, when Bill talks about that, feeling like he had arrived, for me, that was it. It was neon lights, cash, all the free booze I could drink. And at that time, I was maybe 22 years old, 21, 22, something like that. I read an article that said you might be an alcoholic if you drink this amount a week. And I just remember thinking, I'll drink that in a couple of hours. Easy. Every single night. Every night. And, you know, drugs are a part of my story, but the drugs that I took were just a way to get me to drink more. If it could keep me up longer or make me feel better when I was hungover, they were always a side, and they all led back to alcohol. I mean, I tried one or the other to not drink. I'm not going to drink. I'm just going to do coke. I'm not going to drink. I'm just going to smoke pot. But truly, none of that worked, and it always, always led me back to alcohol. That was the love of my life. It made it possible for me to be in the world with you. It gave me the ability to cope. It also made me extremely violent and a thief and a liar. And I went to jail a lot. But when you grow up like I did, in that kind of chaos, with the people I grew up with, normal is relative. To me, getting your lights cut off was normal. Getting your car repoed was normal. Going to jail became normal. I never moved because I wanted to move, ever. I moved because I got evicted, always. I spent all my money on alcohol, and I would worry about the bills later. And it just made it real hard to hit a bottom when life was that crazy. I worked in dance clubs and hung around strippers and drug dealers and musicians, and my life was insane. But I would have told you it was fun. And it was. It was fun. I met a rock star, and going on tour, and drinking every night, and backstage passes, and musicians and strippers, and the nightlife, and the free booze, and I was in heaven. I could have died like that. I was having so much fun, in spite of the consequences. They just weren't enough yet. I wouldn't have quit if my life depended on it. What I didn't know was I was slowly, slowly approaching that invisible line that all alcoholics eventually cross, where I was going to lose any choice in the matter. My disease was progressing. The consequences were still pretty bad for a normal person, but it was still worth it for me. I didn't know I had an option. I didn't even need one, really. My sister and I partied a lot together. We went everywhere together. And we had so much fun. And what I know today, the disease of alcoholism doesn't just happen. I feel like I was born with it. I feel like my childhood, the uncomfortable feelings, going to kindergarten and feeling like a square peg in a round hole, that feeling has never left me until I got here, until y'all told me how to be in a room full of people and be okay in my own skin. I was never okay in my own skin, not even as a child. And I know alcohol cured that for me. It fixed it for me. I wanted to read this before I started, but you know, there's a lot about our stories that can be a little bit embarrassing. You know, I had to talk to my sister on the way here. In 15 years, she's never heard me say this, but and I had to ask her permission because there's some things you just don't share with the outside world. But because of this book. And because of the, you know, I sponsor women and I know how necessary it is to share our painful past. This is from The Family Afterword on page 124. It says, Henry Ford said, "The experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is willing to turn the past to good account. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that in God's hands the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them." I have to remember that my past is the key and not the lock. So I share with you this descent, I guess, into my bottom, which for a long time I wouldn't share. I was 10 years sober before I ever told anybody that I was in that dance business or in that the nightlife or in the business at all. There was a lot of shame and humiliation that came along with it. But today I know that because I've shared, people have been helped. When things started to get so painful for me was when I was pregnant, actually. My sister had a son and a baby, and this explains a lot. The book tells us that some people are hard drinkers. You know, she drank like me. We looked the same. We used the same. We partied the same. We hung out with the same people. Life was awesome. But it tells us that when we have a sufficient reason to stop, a hard drinker can stop, be it their health or a new child or a life-changing event. So she stopped. She just stopped. She had a baby. She made a decision. And she doesn't drink anymore. Less than a year later, I got pregnant. And I couldn't. And life wasn't fun anymore. My life had been spiraling into the toilet, truly, for the last year. And I wanted to stop, but I just couldn't. Now I'm pregnant, and I thought, surely I'll stop. And I couldn't. And I have a picture of myself, the big belly, hungover after New Year's Eve because I had spent the night pouring champagne into these little styrofoam cups because everybody else was having so much fun. And I thought I was not going to get to have any fun. That's what I told myself. What I didn't understand is I was an alcoholic. I had an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. The little voice in my head said, "You have to drink. You can't survive without it. There is no life without alcohol." And then once I started drinking that little shot of champagne that all of society says it's good for you when you're pregnant, go ahead and drink it. What they didn't understand, and certainly what I didn't understand, was that it was about to set in motion a night of doing anything I could to hide whatever I could drink. And I was drinking, somebody had a drink with a cigarette in it that I drank because I was trying to sneak it so fast. And I'm pregnant, and I'm drinking all the champagne I can consume. And, you know, I had a hangover the next day, one of those, oh, I want to die, my head is splitting open, you know, alcohol poisoning kind of hangovers, and I'm pregnant. So I get through that. I have my daughter who, you know, women can relate to this, and I didn't know that. But when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous and meet women and work with women, they understand that even a new, beautiful, perfect baby is not going to win over untreated alcoholism. There's a monster, and there's nothing I can do to stop it. And I still didn't have any information. I went back to work in the strip clubs, and I was 12-stepped in a strip club. You know, this is my first indication that God is in control, that I don't know what's good or best or right for anybody. I would tell you working in a strip club is not a good idea for anyone. But the truth is, I don't know if I would have made it here if I wasn't there. Two separate people came to me. I went to my first meeting at Triangle, left there uncomfortable. I didn't have that experience where I was home. That time I left and I drank. And then the next time, I had been up for a few days. I don't know how many days. I had a baby. I was living with my sister. And coming down, I just wanted to die. The booze ran out. Everything ran out. And that, you know, I would do anything to not get to that. It's running out place. If I had to go for days and days and steal and lie and cheat. But it all ran out and I was stuck. And I just had a breakdown. I remember breaking some things, you know, freaking out, and my sister bringing me here to NABA. Now, I had a baby in a car seat, and she sat out there and waited for me while I came into the meeting. I sat at the back of the room. I didn't take any numbers. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I cried and cried, and I went home. And I came back. I came in late. I sat in the back of the room. I didn't take any numbers. I didn't even pay attention to the 12 steps or the 12 traditions or the big book. And eventually, I would go to three meetings a week, then one meeting a week, then no meetings a week. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't do anything that was suggested. I didn't even listen. I didn't drink for a little while, and I felt better after a few weeks. I don't know how many weeks, maybe six or something like that. And then life happens, and I was left with my insanity, my untreated alcoholism, and I drink again. And those last few months of my daughter's first year of her life were hell. They were sheer hell. I stayed up for days. I drank every single day. And towards the end, I just wanted to die. And dying really wasn't even good enough anymore. I didn't want to leave my daughter behind. So I had suffered from the abandonment of a parent who left and never came back. My father died when I was 11. So in my alcoholic insanity, I started thinking that suicide was a good idea, but taking my daughter with me was a better idea. And for months, I drove around planning this thing and not telling anybody, not having anyone to tell. And it was real to me. It was a real solution. So when I talk about a mother who could do some of the things that my mom did, here I am, making this kind of a decision, and it was real. It was a real option, and it seemed like the right thing to do for everybody involved. She wouldn't be left alone, and I wouldn't be left here to destroy anybody else's life. And I don't know how we made it out of that, because I've worked with women since then who have carried through with that, women who have almost carried through with it, and there's, you know, not a lot of people who are willing to sit across from them and tell them they love them anyway. And I can do that, and I can believe it. I feel it. And I've said this before, that's not something you just share in an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe God orchestrates all of that. Somehow I've been able to be matched up with women who have harmed their own children. The reason I can do that is because when I first got sober, I went to a retreat, and this little lady looked a lot like Helen, stood at a podium and shared that she had done the same thing. She put her children in their pajamas and mixed up the sleeping pill and their orange juice and She had the gun in her bedroom and all three of her children, and she was going to do that. And this was my deepest, darkest secret. I hadn't told my sponsor or anybody at that time. I was sober, but I wasn't going to share that. And there was this woman who had the courage to stand up and tell the truth. I broke down, and the very next day I completed that fourth step and told the truth about myself. And I think ever since then, God has been able to use me and that experience and many others to help another woman. I crawled into Easy 123 in Duluth then, and I was really sick. I decided I was going to go. I was working nights, so I drank all night. I got up the next day, and I'd been up for days. I didn't get up. I'd been up for probably 4 or 5 days, and I was not going to drink. And I did go to sleep that morning. I woke up in the afternoon, went to a meeting, and then went home. And by then, about 5 o'clock is when I started drinking. I'd wake up at 2 or 3 and start drinking and then be gone. Well, I started to shake. My ex was on the road. He was gone. It was just the baby and I. And, we had sheets on all the windows and towels. I was paranoid. I hadn't eaten in days. And, I would have told you I was a good mother while I laid on the couch all day long, drinking or nursing a hangover, staying up all night long with my baby, because she didn't sit in a dirty diaper. She never went without formula. I managed to do those things for her and had convinced myself that I was a good mother. And the book tells me that the alcoholic life seems to be the only normal one. I can't differentiate the true from the false. And I felt superior to other people at that time. And if you could have seen the condition of my home and me, it's unbelievable what we can delude ourselves into believing. So somehow I got up and went to that meeting, and I didn't care if I died or if I went to AA. They both were equally unappealing to me. And the book also tells me that, finding recovery, relying on God, or dying an alcoholic death, that wasn't an easy decision to make, and that was true for me. I went to the noon meeting there every day. That first week I was sick. I shook and I hallucinated. I threw up. I cried. I couldn't drive. Somebody would come get me and bring me to the meeting. Somebody would take my baby and help me. We spent most of that time. She cried. I stayed on my knees and just asked God for help. I cried. But I got to the meeting. I met some great people there. Wonderful people. I started to listen. I got a big book. I got a sponsor. It makes a big difference to get the direction from somebody, to not just sit there. I did, at that time, there was a guy in the meeting, and I have to share, this isn't something I shared until I got into service. And they asked me to do a panel on safety in AA. Last year, I'm the alternate DCM for 16C, and I talked about safety in AA. And my experience has been that at that time, there was a man who would come out after the meeting and ask me out. And I'd leave, and I'm newly sober, still shaking, brand new, not a clue how to be in the world without alcohol. And he would ask me out, and I'm in a relationship, and no, I can't. But every single day, he came and followed me to my car. Now, I don't have the skills. I certainly don't have any boundaries. I started drinking when I was 11. I didn't know how to handle without violence. In a club with bouncers, yeah, I can handle that. But in the real world, in the broad daylight, I was terrified and ashamed. So the guy never went away, and then he started showing up at my work, which, by the way, I did go back to work in the clubs, and I don't recommend that. You don't have to do that, but I felt like I had to provide for my daughter and myself. I was as addicted to the money as I was anything else, and I went back to work in the club, and I managed to stay sober in that business for 5 years. And I did help several women and sponsor several women. Like I said, you don't have to do that. You probably don't want to do that. But that was my experience. That was my story. So this guy showed up at my work, and I just couldn't go back to the meeting anymore. And again, I didn't know I had options. I didn't know I could tell my sponsor. I didn't know I could reach out for help. And I did drink again after that. And I went back shortly after, and that was March 10th, 1997. And I say that because it's important. You know, we come here to survive. This disease will kill me. It'll kill you. There's no joke. This is not a dating service. This is no place to come and try to get laid. This is life or death for me and for the young women and the young men that come here. I think our selfishness drives us to do things. But we have got to always remember that we come here to live. And what I've learned on the flip side of that is that we're sick people. Just because we're sober doesn't mean we're not very, very sick. And it takes a lot of us time to grow up, to mature. And that even in the beginning of AA, there were people that were, literally, there was a woman thrown out of AA who died drunk because they considered her to be too promiscuous. That's a joke to me today. But this woman was asked to leave AA, and she died drunk. So even when there are people who are not necessarily stalking, but behaving inappropriately, you know, they deserve a place to come and get sober. And I'm so grateful for that, because men and women both do those things. And the fact that they can come here, be safe, and get recovery is a miracle to me. It doesn't happen everywhere. You know, everybody deserves a chance to get sober, regardless. So I've learned a lot about tolerance and grace and praying for people that I used to want to be victimized by. Like I said, I got sober. I started working on a written first step. And this is not in the book, but it's something my sponsor had me do. She wanted me to take a piece of paper and write down how I was powerless and how my life was unmanageable. And what an eye-opener. You know, I don't think I could have stayed sober until I was able to concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. You know, I didn't know what alcoholism was. I didn't know about the disease. I didn't know about the obsession or the allergy. All I know is that when the alcohol started running low, I got really uncomfortable. And if the waitress didn't bring my drink fast enough, I was prone to flip tables and clear off bar tops and jerk people over bars by their hair. I was waiting at the liquor store for it to open early in the morning. I would drive hours to get somewhere where they were still serving alcohol. I got uncomfortable and antsy, and the idea of not getting that next drink would make me anxious. And I didn't know what that was. I thought everybody felt that way. Closing time was a terrible thing for me. You know, I would spend a lot of money to buy booze from the bartender so I could bring it home because it was already too late to get it from the liquor store. I didn't know what powerlessness was until I went back over my life and looked at all the times I said I was not going to do it today. And I told you that the last couple years when I just didn't think it was fun anymore. This time I went to jail and I got in real trouble. I went into a whiteout and I put a girl in the hospital and I went to jail, and it cost me a whole lot of time and money to get myself out of that one. And, you know, I wanted to stop, and I got up every single day and said, I am not going to do it today. I'm not doing it. I'm not drinking today. God help me. I'm not drinking today. And I would white knuckle my way down to work, and I'm still working in the clubs, and I get there. I walk in the door, and 5 minutes later, I'm on the floor in front of the bar drinking my third or fourth Wild Turkey, going, how did it happen again? I would be staggering drunk within an hour and not know how I got there. And I woke up begging God to keep me sober that day. I did not want to drink. We had to blow in a breathalyzer in the clubs. We do in Atlanta anyway. And I spent hundreds of dollars bribing people to give me my keys. I spent hundreds of dollars on cabs. I spent hundreds of dollars just trying to avoid that whole situation. I stuck a mouthful of pennies in my mouth because somebody told me that worked. Ugh, it didn't work, and it's nasty. And I still had to spend $200 to get my keys back from the house mom. But, you know, it just didn't matter. All night long, I said, I'm going to not drink after 1 o'clock. I'm going to stop. And I couldn't stop at 1. Now, I knew I had a baby to go get from a babysitter's in my car. They had my keys. I had to blow in a breathalyzer. I couldn't leave and go get my baby. And I could not stop. And didn't know why. I'm just going to drink this Wild Turkey and then water and then Wild Turkey and then water. I'm just going to drink beer tonight. I'm just going to drink wine tonight. I'm just going to take pills tonight. Nothing ever worked. I always ended up drunk and didn't understand why. I didn't know anything about the allergy, the craving that kicked in once I started drinking. So that written first step really opened that up for me. I could see who and what I was, and there was a freedom. I mean, a real freedom. I'm not crazy. I'm not a bad person. I mean, I'm not the worst mother. I have alcoholism, and it sounds like I have a solution. If you're sitting here with over 40 years of sobriety, and you're sitting here, and you're sitting here, this must work. There must be an answer for me. I don't have to live like this anymore. And I became willing to go to the meetings on time, to stay, and to listen. Bill Lason used to tell me, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle. It was real uncomfortable when I got sober. It turned out I needed some medication. You know, I was just, I don't know that everybody does, but y'all told me I could go and seek professional help, and I could trust them. So I did. And they put me on some medication for, what was it now? Bipolar and some other stuff. Who knows what else? Whatever. It helped me to stay sober. I don't take it today. But I did see a psychiatrist, which, by the way, I had been doing for years. I had dozens and dozens of self-help books that I would try to read at 2 o'clock in the morning with one eye and figure out what was wrong with me. None of that worked. The psychiatric effort, self-help. I heard a preacher say, self can't help. You can't go into the same organ that's messing you up and try to fix yourself with it. So he said, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle. And I believed him because I really wanted a drink. I was pissed. I was so angry all the time. And I hadn't started enough work on the steps to get any relief yet. I didn't realize this was my medicine. So I would come to the meetings and I would cuss and scream and just be hateful. But I would come back. I started working on the steps and I did get a little bit of relief. The written first step gave me the freedom. It gave me, you know, the permission to live my life sober, to make a decision at every turn to not drink, no matter what. It's not an option for me anymore. I don't care what happens. And divorce sucks. You know, people dying sucks. Big life changes. Getting fired from your job for sleeping with the president of the company is humiliating, and it sucks. Do I have to stand up like a big girl, face the world, and stay sober? Yeah, I did. I made some of the worst mistakes I have ever made in my drunken life, in sobriety, stone sober, going to meetings. In a lot of cases, not all. Some I stopped going to meetings like I should, stopped calling my sponsor, and I made the biggest mistakes. When I disconnected from my meetings, I started lying to my sponsor and my friends, and I made some really big mistakes. So what I know today is that being sober is just the beginning. The alcohol was a symptom. I've got to continually work on my sobriety. I've got to work the steps every day. I've got to work with other alcoholics every day. I've got to read the literature every day. Or I'm going to go right back into that insane thinking and make some way big mistakes. You know, I read in Freedom from Bondage, this is my favorite story, Winlaw wrote this one, and I felt like a bullseye when I read it. But, you know, I talk about my childhood and I talk about some of the stuff that's happened in this lifetime. I just really wanted to be a victim. You know, I got through the steps up to 6 and 7, and that's that lifelong process of always looking at your character defects. And not that long ago, like in the last 2 years, I sat down with my sponsor and she uncovered finally this victimization I had. It just made it possible for me to always blame you for all the crap going on in my life. And you would think that would be one of the big ones that you catch right away, but not me. I had to suffer from it for 13 years. But if I'm not careful, that kind of victimization will get me drunk. It seemed like a good idea a couple times, you know, because it was just poor me, poor me. Winlaw said, the medical profession might say I was conditioned for alcoholism by the things that happened to me as a child. AA has taught me that I am the result of the way I reacted to what happened to me as a child. Through this program, I may experience a change in that reaction pattern that will allow me to match calamity with serenity. And that's been my experience. I've learned by watching the women in the program who stay sober, by doing the steps, working the steps, looking at my part, which is painful when I want to be right more than anything. I have this disease of I got to be right. And to sit down and face that, talk with my sponsor, go back and make amends when I'm wrong, and always deflating that ego, I find that I can react to life more like a sane and normal person. My sister will tell you, I still don't. I still blow. I still act like a child. I still want my way. I want to be right. I'm very selfish and self-centered. Things happen to me and not for me. But it certainly is better. And I've got a shot. And I don't have to drink over any of it today. Well, that's, you know, freedom for me. That's new. And staying sober was just the beginning. But what I found was real high maintenance. You know, I wanted to look into this higher power thing. I had a God when I came here. I had a real white bread Methodist God from Milwaukee. And they didn't even say Jesus or anything in church. It was something you fall asleep during, you know. And they didn't talk about it at home. And when I got here, I believed in God, but I believed he didn't want anything to do with me. I really believed I was just too despicable. So getting to a place where I believed he loved me, it was profound. One of the first spiritual experiences I had was when those little footprints cards, somebody handed it to me, and my ex had played golf. So there was a little golf pencil next to the bed, and I remember reading the bottom part of it, "My precious child, I love you, and I'll never leave you." And it was when you saw one set of footprints that I carried you. I don't know what it was, but it really knocked me out of my bed and onto my knees. Literally knocked me out of my bed and onto my knees, and I felt it within. And from then on, I started to seek. I got back into the church and started learning how to serve my community like you taught me to do, to make commitments. And, you know, one of the things I found was through my church, I started serving the co-op, the food resources in Gwinnett County. I don't even know if I'm supposed to say their names, but I started working there and realized that we had to get food when we lived in Cincinnati from the food bank. That was a food store. But here in Gwinnett County, they're really nice. They're like inside and nice. Where we went was in Cincinnati and over the Rhine, and that's the ghetto in the winter. And we had to stand outside and down an alley where there was urine and dead rats and get our little bag, which felt like Christmas when you get this bag of food. And sometimes it was. It was like Thanksgiving, and we'd get home with this bag of food. And that was how we lived. There were many days the only thing we ate was the free lunch we got at school. And today, without ever thinking about that until I was in the situation, I can give back. And this program has given me a purpose. You know, I don't have any real big gifts or abilities. I'm a mom. I try to be the best mom I can be today, and I serve my family and my children. But it feels so good to have a purpose. This program has given me a reason to be here. I have something of value, my experience, strength, and hope. And not only can I serve alcoholic women and other alcoholics, this group, your group, my group, AA at the area level, AA at the district level, I can serve my church, my community, my children's school. I'm so willing to give of my time for fun and for free. Selfish people like me don't do that. I have never known myself to ever not ask the question, what's in it for me? All of my life, from very young age, I didn't do anything unless there was a payoff for me in the end. And today, I get a buzz off of that giving, and I need it. You know, I got to do a lot of things. I got to serve. I started making coffee. I started greeting early. And then somebody pushed me into doing like secretary or grapevine rep, and I never wanted to do that. It feels like any service position I held, I just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and got a job. I didn't go out after any of it. But today, I honestly believe that newcomers might need a job more than they need a big book those first few days. You know, I couldn't be here. I couldn't walk into a room full of people and be at ease. I was ate up with self-centeredness. I was so uncomfortable all the time. It would drive me away. I didn't know how to do that sober. I really thought you were all looking at me. And what I learned today is this is just my ego. It's pride. But I thought because you were thinking bad things. Look at her. She's a stripper. Look how shabby she looks. She must be really poor. Look how selfish she looks. Look what she's done to her children. Look what she's done to the people that, you know, she loves. I felt like you could read it on me everywhere I went. And I was that transparent. And it was impossible for me to stand in a room full of people. It was so hard. And in sobriety, I called my sponsor. Tell me what to wear. I don't know how to dress. I don't know how to speak. I could not say the F word. You know, for a long time, I still struggle with that. And you know, I'd go, I'm back in church, and I'm going with these good Christian people, and I did not know how to be. I felt like I had, like, a blinking red light over my head. And serving AA, coming in here and having a job, if I could stand by that coffee pot and be responsible to get coffee in it, I had a place to be, and nobody could run me off. There was nothing that could happen in my head that would tell me I had to abandon my post because I was uncomfortable. I had a job and a reason to be here, and you didn't get to judge me. And that's what I came here with. It gave me the glue that made my feet stick in the room and do what I had to do. It started to build my self-esteem. I have a purpose, a believable purpose, not just me telling myself I'm a good person. This is me doing acts at first because I didn't get that whole grace thing. I didn't understand that. So I did good acts, and I felt better, and I stayed sober. And next thing I know, I'm secretary, and I was probably the worst group secretary ever. At least that's how I felt. And somehow they asked me to be alternate GSR. Maybe nobody else wanted to do it. I don't know. But I did that, and then I became GSR, and I slowly got involved, and I went to the assembly down in Macon and really, really started to learn what AA looks like when it's working from the ground up, from the group member up to our state delegates. And I love it. I love it today. I don't want to be involved in all that stuff. I just like watching it happen. I like the way AA works. I like that we all get a voice. I like that we all vote on what happens in AA and the people that are, we're trusting them to run the show for us. I like that I've learned how to be responsible with other people's money, maybe not necessarily my own, but if I'm a treasurer, I'm going to treat the group's money like I should. I'm not going to steal it. Wow. Who knew that I could not steal money from the group? You know, I got a job for the first time in AA. I got a job, a real job in a human resources department, and I would go to work on time, and I wouldn't steal anything, not even a pen, not a stamp. And I know everybody around me was doing it, but I didn't. That is a spiritual experience. Paying my bills is a spiritual experience. Being where I said I'm going to be when I say I'm going to be there, a spiritual experience. It's been 15 years now, and I still don't know how I get here from there. I didn't know there was a bridge. My life doesn't look anything like it did then. That hopeless chaos, that just begging God to not let me drink and not feel the pain of just living every day, the fear of hurting the people I love the most, the fear of killing somebody in my car, fear of going to jail for a long, long time, all that fear and anger and the lifestyle, it seems like a different world. And I know that slowly but surely, just living this program, working the steps, working with other people, I've become something else. I've been reborn, like the book tells me I would be. I believe I am today. Heather and I were talking on the way here when I had to ask permission to share some of this stuff about her life. And she said, you know, if you wouldn't have asked me, I would have forgotten that I actually ever was in that business, and I would have been a little embarrassed because I don't believe that I'm that person anymore. And I'm not. And we're not. And I don't ever have to go back there again if I don't drink one day at a time. There's hope for me. AA has opened up a whole new world. And, you know, relationships are so hard. We're alcoholics have this thing in common. We are emotionally immature. You know, we're not necessarily psychopathic, but we're emotionally immature and selfish and self-centered and driven by fear. And relationships are tough for me, all of them. And I've been through 3 marriage divorces and really gave up after this last one. I felt like if I could just raise my kids and not ever get into another relationship, you know, and not seek that, because I use that as a God. And it's amazing what I find when I'm not using alcohol, all the other things that I replace God with in my life. And the book also tells me that job or no job, husband or no husband, kids or no kids, if I place dependence on material things above dependence on God, then I'm just going to be unhappy. I'm going to find misery, and I cannot stay sober. So in spite of reading that, I have tried over the years to place my dependence on everything possible. And in the end, what I found is these idols just bring me misery. So I got to a place where I was going to give them all up, and I told God I'm done. No more men, All right. We're not going to do that. The job is gone. The husband is gone. My grandmother died. My 17-year-old Cocker Spaniel. All that happened at one time. And I felt absolutely alone in the world and had this moment of, okay, it's just God. That's it. And for me, surrendering, not just the alcohol, but everything. You know, I said, God, if I'm going to be alone for the rest of my life, then I'll do that. If I don't ever get another good paying job, then I'll do that. Although that's not my experience. When he takes one thing away, he usually provides another. But if I'm all in the way, things just get complicated. So I hit this point where I gave it all up. And, okay, I'm just going to serve AA. I'm going to serve my church. I'm going to be a good mom and leave it at that. And trying to put God first, I mean, seeking God, working that 11th step every day was a lot more difficult than I thought. And I don't know how you stay sober this long. Maybe not for you, but my experience is I was real slack on those steps. You know, the seeking God. I only fooled myself into believing I was seeking God. And it takes hours out of your day, I found, to get there, for me to get back in line. And I spent hours in prayer and meditation for the first time. And for me, when I first got sober, I'm so hyper and ADD, my sponsor said, just get on your knees for 3 minutes and call me back. And I'd watch the clock and act like I was praying for 3 minutes. And that's what it was. It was a daily discipline of 3 minutes, up to 7 minutes in the morning, and then working my way up. But in the end, I got up to about an hour, and I was really seeking God's face. And things really cleared up for me. I was able to see more of my character defects and have freedom from them. I was able to focus on what really mattered in life and God's purpose and God's will for me. And in that whole relationship thing, you know, at the point that I gave up this idea that I would ever be happily married, I just couldn't do the relationship thing. It was just too hard. And I didn't want to suffer through that again, the divorce. I met somebody, you know. And in the beginning when I got sober, my sponsor said, write down a list of all you want in life, and I bet you shortchange yourself. And she was right. I kept that paper for 5 years. And when I went back and looked at it, all the things that I thought would be the greatest ever if my life could look like this, you know, like normal people like you, like I could have a real job and I could get up on time in the mornings, I could own a car and not get it repoed, and I could pay my bills. Those the normal things that it looked like the whole world had that I could never, ever manage, I was able to do. So if I do that with my relationship, I wrote down a list of things that mattered to me. You know, this wasn't the sex inventory. This wasn't about how I'm going to behave in a relationship. This is about what I think I'm worth. And I wrote those things down, and no sooner did I surrender that part of my life that I met somebody in AA who blew away everything on my list. I mean, I wanted somebody maybe 10 years sober, and maybe they go to church, and maybe they're a father. You know, all these things were nothing compared to what I've been provided. And, you know, there's a man, he's going to come, Lee's going to come and speak here in November, and you'll see what I see, which is God is really good. He loves us. My kids are healthy and happy. They're in a great school. They're really active. And I have a good relationship with my family today. I'm employable. I'm really grateful to be sober. I serve AA. I serve AA at my group level and the area level and the district level. And I'm happy. I'm just reasonably happy is not what I have to be anymore. I'm really, really happy. And I'm really, really grateful. And I'm just so glad to be here. So, yeah, really, I know. We all can find that place of, wow, how did I get here? And that's where I spend most of my days. How did I get here? But it takes work. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is not for those who want it. And it's not for those who need it. It's for those who do it. And I found that as long as I'm doing the work, I can stand the beam. And I just really thank you for inviting me here. And that's all I got. Thank you.
Thank you, Joette, for that awesome service work.
First I slip, and then I crib. A hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window, for a heart that beats for me, takes me where the promises are real. For something to set me free, and I'd love to move in harmony. Still.